The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete is the stinger but without the venom. Rand is shushed by someone unknown somewhere unknown. So he eases off and only does multidimensional symmetry algebra, and that's what's up, Doc. Cognitive defense explains what the heck that even means. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go!
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Greetings. We have Doug Simmons and Dave Bailey here from Cognitive Defense. So let me just start with the first question. What is Cognitive Defense, and what's your situation?
Well, this is Doug here, and thanks for the opportunity to speak again, Fred. Cognitive Defense is what we characterize, our tagline, is a thoughtful approach to human risk management. And so what we're doing is creating a research, advisory, and training service to help improve organizations' human risk management and focusing on the human element of risk management around.
So when you say human element of risk management, first of all, risk is a word most people don't understand. So we'll talk about that as uncertainty about the future.
Yes.
And risk management is managing that uncertainty around the future. So risk management for humans presumably is about, well, tell me.
Yep. Well, human cognition is really an important facet of this, right? So when we talk about, I will use the phrase risk management because it is something that I believe resonates with our audience quite well. And when you're talking about human cognition, we really have to focus on how people relate to influences, both internal and external, that may be working against the corporate good, the good of the company, from a financial, from a goodwill, from however it needs to be categorized.
All right. So for example, spam emails, you know, lots of people, you know, not just spam, but malicious emails trying to trick you into opening the court. You know, phishing is one of the things it's called. It's not just that, right? It's everything else. And Dave, you're the sales and marketing guy. So besides selling for the company, presumably sales and marketing is an influence operation, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way CogDef is being positioned is it should be considered as like a resource that identifies or helps an organization better identify human behavior and what some of the potential mistakes people can make in an organization inadvertently in reaction.
Okay, hang on. So the thing here is what you're saying, your communication here is an example of an influence operation. Mm-hmm. And your company is about defending against influence operations, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So why are we not defending against you trying to sell us Cogda?
Well, you can.
But we could be potentially a threat depending on how we're perceived. Yes.
Yeah, well, if if you're pitching to a competitor, Dave, then that probably is a threat, right? So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every external entity that approaches a company is potentially a threat in some way, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So is this just about talking to people, or is there some technology? Because this is the cyber show.
Yeah.
There must be some cyber components to it. So what's the cyber component to CogDef?
There's a few pieces of the cyber component to it. But let me just make it clear that, you know, the enterprise, any organization, any type of organization has information that is really important to the ongoing business functionality of that and staying in business and maybe being successful in business. External parties want to get at that information, and the way they get at it typically is through people. If you look back over the past 15 years or so, most of, if not all of the breaches have been through some form of social engineering or influence operation or trickery or fraud, whereby the bad actors were able to gain entry to an enterprise IT infrastructure and move laterally by defrauding people, like I said, social engineering, email phishing, those kinds of things. So what we're trying to do is help the people aspect of it. Those people have fallen victims to fraud, right? When they're
But how are you using technology? The bad guys are using cyber. You know, you hear these stories that they're now using ChatGPT and AI to automatically generate their frauds.
Yes.
So presumably, if we don't start using AI to defend against them, we're going to lose.
Yep. We're using AI in a couple of areas like everybody else. But no, in all seriousness, there are two ways we're doing this. Number one is we need to identify what the organization looks like in terms of how it is set up and who has access to important information. And do some sort of analysis in terms of how those people operate and what risk could be associated with them should they be influenced or engineered in such a way.
Yeah, so these are the potentially serious negative consequences associated with influencing them, right?
Right. So not everybody in the organization is of the same general risk. Let me put it that way. So we want to identify those who may pose a greater risk to the organization because
for an example, the person that has access to the trade secrets for Coca-Cola, if they turn against you and they you're screwed. Sorry,
you said it exactly.
Sure. Use that word on the show, yes, but
So once we identify who those people are, what we're looking for is a subset of the organization like that we need to focus a little more attention on to make sure that their cognitive development is stronger. And the way we do that, Fred, is I think a real novel approach and one that is gaining a lot of, traction across the industry and other areas is that with training by gaming. We're developing an AI based, and I mean that in all seriousness, an AI based training by gaming platform that allows us to help these people participate. When I say help them, ask them to participate in a fun and rewarding experience, a game that is rolled out.
Right. Let's talk about training by gaming because we see all these games. Is this like a live action game? Is it a single shooter game?
Not at all. Yeah. So how it is we set up scenarios where people are attempting to be influenced by the game itself. The game is, of course, is running a large language model, generative AI.
Talk about that. Hang on. So. Yep. We see all these people that'll send out spam, right? Mm-hmm. We claim to be good guys, and we're going to spam your employees and get them to respond. So, is that what you're doing?
No, not at all. No, the game is something that's more, focused on having fun, where you're participating with some of the other members of the organization that have been identified again as higher risk, like I was saying earlier, and then attempting to interact with them, yes, through their email system and yes, through their maybe social media platform of use. And it's not spam. It's tightly controlled because it's really important that we don't go in there and create a worse problem than it existed before.
So is this running over the corporate email system and over the corporate communications infrastructure?
Not necessarily. No, I'm trying to stay away from that. If the organization wants that to happen, we can make it happen. But no, we're trying to keep this much more self-contained, so that it is a way to help people train their neurons to detect fraud.
It'll also, just so we're clear, if you do it that way, that means you're going to keep it out of the corporate system, so you're not going to burden the corporation with the extra potential bad things happening, and there's no chance of it interfering with normal operation.
It has,
right?
It has to be that way, right? And it, I think it's important to say what we're not doing is yet another, you know, email phishing training exercise at all. What we're trying to do is from the whole aspect of influence operations and how influencing actually works. We were joking earlier about, you know, the sales process.
Is this helpful? It wasn't a joke. Sales process is an influence operation. Yeah. Is this helpful beyond the company itself? So the employees going through this process, does it help them in the rest of their lives?
Yeah, we're hoping so. And I have to be honest with you here, Fred, because it's more of a kind of a personal focus that I have, is to just increase critical thinking skills as much as possible to help people identify when they're being defrauded or when they're being used as rubes, right? When they're not thinking something through or they're taking something at face value.
The useful idiot, I think, is the term that the Russians use to describe
That's it, exactly. And we don't want to be denigrating anybody in anybody's organization, but there are a lot of people that have access to very sensitive information that we want to help the organization improve cognitive defense.
Just about sensitive information. When you say sensitive, is an interesting word, right? Because it's not just leaking of secrets, which is very important for trade secrets, but it's also about, you know, the person who's running the infrastructure who gets convinced to, but in a protest, down the company, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. To poke a hole in the firewall just for this one because they were influenced to do so. Absolutely correct. Yes. I concur wholeheartedly.
Yep. There you go. All right. So look, I love the chat. And Dave, I'm sorry you only got, you know, one question in there, but we do have to move on. Thank you so much. And we're going to be seeing you soon, I'm pretty sure, in events coming up around the country. I understand you're going to the Enterprise Leadership Network events. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. That is a wonderful place to meet people who are interested in this type of approach. So, we're looking forward.
So if you're going to ELN, you know, you can see Doug there and say hello to him, and probably you'll be able to see Dave there too. They're great guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Fred.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. For a double. Papers flying. Everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee-whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The expanding war in the Middle East is consuming resources and destroying infrastructure of the terrorist groups in Yemen, Gaza, the West Bank, and other Iranian-backed areas. As a side effect, they are no longer focused on mass frauds against Western targets. And this is apparently reducing the frauds affecting the West. And that's breaking spam on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Okay, I want to start by saying that I'm not really certain of what happened recently, but I'm getting far fewer fraudulent emails than in the past. While this is probably a really good thing in general, it's really not as good for this segment of the show. Drat. However, here's a reasonably interesting recent fraud we came across. Oh, it starts out, your account password is expired on whatever date, 15th of January, 2024. And it claims to be from MailChimp. The only problem is I didn't actually have a MailChimp account under this particular ID. But, you know, other than that, it's pretty good. It says, your account password has expired. The password for the account with the username, whatever it was, expires on 15 January 2024. To continue using your secured password,
click here. Okay. Oh, and it, well, it has a copyright at the bottom. That's a copyright for me, my email address, not MailChimp. And the address is not where MailChimp is, and so forth. It does have terms of use and a privacy policy, just in case you were wondering. And the click here points to some weird domain having nothing to do with MailChimp, of course. So, you know, it's sort of a ridiculously obvious attempt at getting me to enter in my new password or my old password, what have you, so it can get a password to my MailChimp account, which can then be used to get the email addresses of all the people I communicate with through MailChimp, and then, of course, send them emails. Well, it's not a really good fraud, but what can I say? The fraudsters seem to be running out. Either that or the anti-fraudsters are getting really good. In any case, I just thought you'd want to know about this one. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. This segment is called How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. How do they do that? Well, it's pretty easy to do a bad email forgery. First, you have to get on a system that allows you to log in as someone else and that sends emails. In this particular case, someone has been able to do that for some time with this particular email address. Then you just send emails as if you were, in fact, from wherever it is that you're claiming to be from. In this case, MailChimp. Even though you are not, of course, from there. All you have to do is lie, and you win. To lie in this way, you just configure your email system with the user ID you want to lie about, and use the password for that account on the system you have access to, and off you go. Indeed, recently, the bad folks have been configuring those systems to act as if they were me sending out emails from a domain that I own, even though there is no actual outbound email on that domain. Maybe that's why companies that service emails are increasing their requirements for authenticity in allowing you to send email from their servers. And that's how you do that.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
All right, we're back with Pete. So after you got elevated in the store to a higher position based on the limitation of what you stole, stealing less than the other employees, and your cleverness in making fake IDs and so forth. So what happened next? Let's move through the next phase.
Yeah, so the district manager asked me if I would use my ID and go on beer stings with him.
Oh, no. He was telling you to use your fake ID to go out and verify whether other stores would catch it. And if they didn't catch it, if they didn't figure it out, then that was the sting. Is that right?
That was it. Now, I was authorized to use the ID with managers who are selling and assistant managers, but not with regular employees. With them, I should buy and have no ID. I should just try to convince them to sell to me.
Got it. All right. So how effective was your capacity to identify or induce people to unauthorized activities?
Well, this is where it got weird because so my ID was good and everybody would take that. Yeah, it looked authentic. And I had to explain to the district manager that this is just how it is and that he shouldn't use this as an actual test because people would definitely fall for it.
Yeah, you should take a worse fake ID. One that they should be able to detect, so you know whether they're intentionally accepting it because they can to get the sale, or whether they're in fact, you know, trying to look for it.
Which is exactly what I told them, and this is what we did. So I had a student ID. Now, back then, so a few years before us, they removed the date of birth from the student IDs. So none of the new student IDs had them. So at the time, this girl that I was seeing, she worked in the dean's office and she had access to the boxes of student IDs. So I made one with a date of birth for myself.
Naturally, a honey trap.
Yeah. So I did it because for my fake ID, I needed a second ID in case they challenged me and said, no, yeah, this isn't real. Do you have another ID? And then I would pull that out and say, this is my student ID.
So you had redundancy.
Yeah.
You know, if you want assurance, you use redundancy. That's right.
And so we did that. And because they all should have known that the college no longer had date of birth on there. Yeah. And of course, they didn't, or some of them didn't. It didn't matter because they sold to me anyways.
Right.
And in which case, the first time it happened, I went back to the car and with my six pack and he got out and he went inside and he fired the person, the assistant manager, on the spot. And because he was saying that could cost them at least $10,000, if not jail time, you know, so $10,000 and probably jail time.
Yeah, you did something you knew was illegal and it's punishable as a crime, but we're only going to fire you because that's better than the alternative of you going to jail or us going to jail.
And I felt absolutely horrible to see that woman crying because I manipulated and social engineered her to sell me the beer.
Yep. Well, technically, then it wouldn't be criminal on her part because she was being induced. Well, but you weren't working for law enforcement because only if you're working for law enforcement is it illegal.
I didn't know that.
Well, whether you know it or not, it's still true. Okay, there you go. Keep going.
Yeah, and so what happened was we would go and I would get just normal people, not management, and I would often convince them to sell to me. And I would just convince them, telling them I don't have my ID, come on, you know,
whether it was out in the car.
I was either going the bro route or you know, trying to flirt with the woman working there. And a lot of times it worked.
People are people. They trust each other because it's part of the human thing.
And every time they sold to me, they would ask me for money. And that's when I would say, the district manager's in the car, put that away. Take the beer away from me. Because it's not like I was wired and my back was to the window.
Right. You were trying to explain to them, yeah. But on the other hand, it probably improved their behavior. And some of them said, no, I'll rather just offend the district manager. Is that the intelligence test for retention of employment?
they were all like turned white as ghosts, right? And I said, listen, if you sell this to me, you're going to be fired. If you sell to anybody who doesn't have a proper ID, you will be fired and probably go to jail. And they were very scared. And I would just tell them, I'm going out. I'm going to tell them you didn't sell, and let this be your warning. And that's how I did it. And I did this for, I don't know, a few months.
Did you tell the district manager?
No. I just said they didn't sell to me.
Which was factually accurate after they got the money back. Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, right. I didn't have the heart, you know. I couldn't manipulate people.
So
I couldn't manipulate people.
Not even for personal gain?
So, you know, this is the hallmark of somebody who just is not going to be a criminal. You know,
right.
He has all the capacity to do so, but he has this moral streak that says, oh, if it's actually harming another person, I just don't want to do it.
Right. Which is why we're all alive today. Right. Yeah. And this is one of the, I wonder, you know, my own path. Yeah, because this is a philosophical thing with me. I think we all worry too much. I think we think the other person is way worse than they actually are. And we'd be better off if we just didn't. And, you know, as I say often, you know, a lifetime in a career in security presents you with these things. Like, why aren't people worse? Why aren't people breaking in and stealing from each other all the time, physically, cybernetically, and so forth? Because people are nice. That's most of it. You know, that's, you know, we haven't just figured out, you know, a good chunk of cybersecurity in my lifetime. We've also done a great deal of archaeology, you know, and anthropology, and, you know, and we understand that, you know, not being nice is not a survival characteristic, right? If you are in a group of, say, 25 or 50 people your entire life, like most of human history, and you're a dink, you get put out and you're not part of it anymore and you die, right? It's literally been bred out of us, right? People are generally decent pretty well all of the time. Otherwise, everything would be stolen tomorrow.
Well, and we do have lots of problems that way with groups of people, you know, gangs and so forth that go into stores and coordinate their activities. But I think, at least in Pete's case, this probably is one of those moments that determines the rest of your life.
Right.
You know, I mean, so if you look at the history here, was, you know, the professors were getting him to break the law for their benefit. Now the guy in the store is getting, you know, him to do things to harm other people with his skills at hacking people and taking advantage of him. He's been taken advantage of. His, you know, he's been poor all of his life. You know, he's eating hot dogs from, you know, old bad hot dogs from the, you know, local 7-Eleven or whatever it is, you know, at the end of their life, you know, as part of his food source. And yet he makes the decision that he doesn't want to hurt other people. And note also that the neighborhood he's in, as he's told us before, you know, is not a neighborhood that's friendly to him. It, you know, it's a, remember, this was quite a while ago when racial issues were much more severe than they are today, even though they're not that gentle today in the United States. And so he's, you know, a stranger in a strange land. And yet something in him is just, he's a feeling person. He doesn't right. want to harm other people. He wants to do the right thing. He wants to do the good thing, but he's always in circumstances. And he's, you know, trying to do his best to make his way through the world with really bad ethical guidance.
Right.
You know?
You know, and I'm constantly talking about how wonderful people are, right, intrinsically and so forth. But you can break us, right? And life can just do that to you and put you in situations where you make those choices. You make the wrong choice, and it's going to last the rest of your life. Sorry, right? And I think that's, you know, we live in enough of a media content world that we've all seen the movies. You know, now we've seen all sorts of them, right? And, you know, before our times, there was, you know, written stories and novels and oral, you know, traditions for hundreds of thousands of years telling the story about how someone made the wrong choice, you know, faced with that, and their life never worked out again. And I honestly believe, you know, the nefarious people you see, and they're out there, as hallmark as this sounds, you know, they were some innocent little baby at some point, and somewhere along the line, they made the wrong choice, and they're living with it.
I'm going to tell you, I know some people, I've encountered some people in my world who I think, you know, demon seed might be the right word for it. But no, I think there are different people that are inherently, so everybody is, you know, born with whatever they are, they inherit it, including, you know, so you have people who are born whose, you know, mother, for example, was taking drugs. And so they have limitations in the way they can think about things, you know, physical and mental limitations. And then you have people who, you know, when they grew up, there was lead paint on the walls and it tasted sweet and they were hungry. So they ate lead paint and it knocked down their IQ. And you have, and so forth. So there's nature and nurture involved. But I do think there are people that are just not, what's the right word for it? Something in them is not willing to or able to see things the way the rest of people see things. They're antisocial. And then you have people who, regardless of their physicality, are brought up in these societies where, you know, it's just, they're brought up to hate people. You know, this is, you know, we're hearing these stories out of Gaza and of the young educational system in those parts of the world and how they're brought up with these images and views of things. And some of them come out of it, but a lot of them don't. A lot of them spend the rest of their lives in this belief system.
Well, and this, it's worth saying, right? You know, this, you know, I don't know, my browsing history, the algorithms decided to present a lot of Carol O'Connor, the actor who played Archie Bunker on All in the Family. And he had a lot to say about bigotry since he played one on TV, the most popular bigot in America in the 1970s. And again, I went to a school, you know, that was uniracial in the neighborhood that was the same and learned a lot of the same things, you know, that would make me certainly unhireable today, right? And if we had to be clear how all this works, you know, I know we have all this, social debate these days in the United States and Canada and a lot of places, but you know, you and I grew up in a country that also had a education system that was heavily biased. Can we say it that way?
You certainly can say that. That might be an understatement. But part of the bias, hang on, part of the bias was towards, I'll call it learning, right? That is, so one of the things about education as opposed to training, right? So training is really supposed to teach you how to do something, and education is supposed to teach you how to think about things, how to be able to figure out what to do.
Well, let's give them credit, though. We owe that in part to the flappers of the 1920s and the hippies of the 1960s and so forth, because, you know, the system that we built in the United States was not built for education. It was built for training, right? It was a post-industrial revolution, post-World War II, you know, one and two, you know, regimented process of training a population. You know, fortunately, you know, we also lived in a country that was you know, founded on the idea of rational thought and so on and so forth. And despite, you know, heavy influences and desire to keep it that way, we've managed to actually create an environment where we're actually learning things, you know, actually figuring things out is more beneficial. And, you know, sort of back to my sort of iterative talk about the evolutionary pressures. One of the reasons the U.S. leads the world economically is not, you know, it's not just cash. It's that there really is something to having a population who really will, on average, try to actually figure things out as opposed to just following the dogma.
As long as we keep it that way. And that's part of the problem, right? So societies evolve over time. And our society is moving in directions that some of us dislike. And I've been writing a lot about this lately and interacting with a lot of people on these sort of subject matters lately. And you see the disinformation of the world. And it's, you know, staggeringly been pushed into universities in the United States and into all sorts of, I'll call them, what's the right, institutions. And without comment on one side or the other, clearly there are very seriously funded and supported influence operations trying to move the way we think about things in different directions. And they're competing with each other in that information arena, in the marketplace of ideas that is the United States, as opposed to other societies where there is no marketplace. You only get the idea that they said you're going to have.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and I, as I've said, you know, I've said to you and many others in our field, you know, in conversations and working groups about, you know, information integrity and disinformation influence campaigns and all that, the success of these globally right now is directly linked to the maturity level of cybersecurity, of information security, right? You know, when you really try, as we talked about like in the last segment about Pete, when you really want to look at, you know, security, turns out people don't do it very well, writ large, period. Right. But it's okay because, you know, you can get away with it. It does well enough. You know, these sort of things, you get into the nuance and complexity of real time information manipulation for good or ill. We don't have a lot of track record with that. We don't have hundreds of years of being able to compare how we did things in the past. You know, this is very much a new world sort of thing. And until we have, you know, the structures and the technology and the processes of information security more matured, it's going to be very hard to deal with.
Or maybe our kids can just cope with it because they were brought up with it, because their brains are wired differently.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, of my 320-something kids, I got a split decision on that when I put the question to them. So we'll see. I have hope.
Perfect way to end this segment. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation.
You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand. Okay, computational complexity. You will want to know this for the upcoming discussion with Rand. Here's my short introduction. Computational complexity has to do with how much time and space it takes to carry out a process using computers. The more complex, the more time it takes as the number of items involved goes up. What's an item? Okay, we're already in trouble. Suppose I want to add up invoice amounts from 100,000 invoices of one thing per invoice. That would be 100,000 items. We'll refer to the number of items as N. Linear time and space means that for every item, it takes a fixed amount of time and space to get to the result. So I can add up the amounts of invoices in linear time, or we call that order of N, because it takes a fixed amount of time to add each new number to the old total, sort of. If the totals get too big, then the size of the storage required might go up and slow things down, but I'll ignore that for now. Log N time means that if I have 100 items, it may only take 10 times as much time as if I had one item. An example of something like this is finding the middle value of a sorted list, because if it's sorted, I can cut the number of higher or lower items in half each time by guessing the item halfway between the last guess and the maximum or minimum established in the last guess. So that reduces the amount of time by half each time. So 100 to start out with becomes 50, then 25, then 12, then 6, then 3, and then I'll find it. Polynomial time means that there's a polynomial expression like 5n to the fifth plus 3n to the third that describes the time and or space required. For 10 items, that particular one comes to 500,000 plus 3,000 or 503,000 steps of time. Exponential time means that the n is the exponent of an equation. So the equation that describes the time, for example, 2 to the n, might seem like it's smaller than the last example, and it will be for a while. Like 2 to the 10th is just, well, 2 times 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 2. In other words, well, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 5, 12, 10, 24. So way less than the 503,000 that we had from 5n to the 5th plus 3n to the 3rd. But if we go to 100, 2 to the 100th is, well, it's 1, 2, 6, 7, 6, 5, 0, 6, 0, 0, 2, 2, 8, 2, 2, 9, 4, 0, 1, 4, 9, 6, 7, 0, 3, 2, 0, 5, 3, 7, 6. Or more than 1 decillion, that is 1 with 30 zeros. Whereas the polynomial time from the previous expression only comes to about 152 million, way less. Now you might ask about parallel processing and its effects on this issue. After all, cloud computing can get you access to hundreds of thousands of computers all at once. It turns out that parallel computing only gets you a linear increase in computational power. So even if you have a million computers working in parallel, you would only remove six zeros from that exponential computing time, or in other words, about 1 followed by 24 zeros would be left. To put this in perspective, if each computer executed one instruction every picosecond, that's 10 to the 15th instructions per second, then the 1 million computers working in parallel would still take 10 to the 9th seconds. So 60 seconds per minute times 60 minutes per hour makes 3,600 seconds per hour times 24 hours per day makes 86,400 seconds per day times 365 days per year makes 31,536,000 seconds per year, or 3 years of a million computers faster than the fastest commercially available computer today. And in case you think quantum computing will solve it all for you, no such luck. Many such algorithms are made faster by quantum computing, but not all of them. Okay, we're back with Rand. And now let's talk about your first influence operation, counter, you know, disinformation operation. Tell us about your dissertation.
Well, so the work was supposed to be this, what I said the title was, the automatic generation of plausible disinformation. And I had a whole theory work that, you know, everybody's familiar with information theory. Well, I thought disinformation theory would be a lot more entertaining. So I had this whole thing.
And I'm sure it was, right?
So, you know, what is the disinformation content of a message? Instead, it was the information content of a message. So I had this whole thing worked out, right? And I took it to my advisor. And I asked him, I said, what do you think about this? And I was in a computer vision lab, you know, when I was doing this. And my advisor was a very, he probably considered to be the founder of the field of computer vision, I would say. And he was a fantastic character. And I said, but he was also heavily involved in the intelligence community because, you know, he was doing a lot of, you know, in those days in the 80s, there was a lot of thing about automatic interpretation of satellite imagery. And of course, because of course, the problem was there was infinitely more imagery than anybody actually, than any human beings had a chance to look at. So most of it just was waste and fell on the floor, on a cutting floor. So, you know, so they were really interested in coming up with automated ways of doing image analysis. So that's the lab I was in. So this had nothing to do with that, right? So I go up to him and I say, look, what do you think about this idea? He says, you know, I'll tell you, he says, here's a number. I want you to call this guy and I want you to explain to him what you have. I said, okay, who is it? He says, that, never mind who it is. Just call the number and tell him I sent you and see what he says.
So now the CIA is talking to you, right?
So I call this number. And a guy answers the phone. He says, hello, extension XYZ. I said, hey, hi, you know, my name is so-and-so. I'm a student of so-and-so. And he told me to give you a call and explain to this idea I had. He says, okay. So I start going through this thing and I'm explaining and I'm talking and I'm talking and I'm talking. And I don't hear a sound from this guy.
Of course not.
Maybe hung up on me. So finally, I asked him, I said, so tell me, I said, so, you know, what do you think? So the first words that come out of this guy's mouth, he says, don't do that.
Don't do that.
I said, what are you talking about? I said, what do you mean? You don't think it'll work? He just said, don't do that. I said, well, come on, you got to give me more than that. I mean, you know, what's the problem? Why do you think this? You think it won't work? Or what do you think? He said, look, he says, we don't do that sort of thing.
You know, who is we?
He didn't say who we were. He just said, we don't do that sort of thing. And he said, and if we did, you would never find the guys who do it. And if you did, they would never tell you.
Yeah, right.
He said, so the best thing is for you to just drop it. And I said, okay, great. So what I did was I continued to work on my own. And for the thesis, I did something completely different.
So, is that right? Okay, so you continued to work on the disinformation theory.
Yes.
But you just didn't tell them about it.
Yes.
Okay, so this goes, you know, maybe you don't know the story about the first paper I gave on computer viruses, which was also in the early 1980s. Uh-huh. I was scheduled to give a paper called Algorithmic Authentication of Identification at the IFIP conference in Canada. Mm-hmm. And International Federation of Information Processing Societies. So I go up there to give that talk, but Harold Hyland had heard about the computer virus thing and suggested that I give the paper on computer viruses instead, and we would just substitute it. We just wouldn't tell anybody ahead of time. I said, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
So I gave that talk. At the end of that talk, a guy comes up and says, you know, I'm from the whatever agency, and, you know, if you would have told us you were going to give this talk, we would have, you know, we would not have let you. And I said, that's why I didn't tell you. Okay, so now I'm coming back through customs from Canada, right? I'm you know, a gradual student. I've got, you know, the t-shirt and jeans and a jacket and a backpack. And, you know, the guy, the border guard looks out, sure, hand me your passport, looks at it, you know, types it in. And his face like goes white as he looks at the screen. And then he goes and searches every single piece of paper, looking at every piece of paper that's there, and eventually lets me pass. He did not do anything with the floppy disks, of course, because they didn't know any. So, and that was the beginning of my encounter with that set of organizations. So I think there's a little bit of similarity in the time frame and the response.
Yeah. So
what was your actual dissertation?
The actual dissertation was, it was about spatial reasoning. And what I did was I developed a new type of representation for polyhedra. And I used it to actually write a program to solve three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles.
Oh, nifty.
Yeah. And this representation was kind of fun because one of the things I wanted the search program to be able to do was to detect symmetries of the pieces, right? Because if you had a piece which had different types of, you know, rotational symmetries, you wouldn't want to put it in one way. And if you had to backtrack, you wouldn't want to take it out, put it in another way, which is geometrically equivalent, right? then you just waste the time. So I needed to come up with a way to calculate symmetries, and using this representation I cooked up, which I called it an analogical representation, which is different than analogical reasoning. This is an analogical representation. It was analogical in the sense that it had an algebraic structure which was isomorphic to the geometric structure of the objects, which meant that a simple algebraic operation you did on the data structure corresponded directly to a geometrical manipulation of the object. So it was the great thing about it was coordinate free and yet had complete metrical and topological information.
So hang on. It didn't have to be three-dimensional. You could do that for an arbitrary number of dimensions.
Yes, you could.
Now we're talking about solving, timed sequential puzzles, right? Four-dimensional puzzles, which are much, much more interesting. Yeah. But all right. So at that time frame, before that, my brother, who went to Carnegie Mellon for his degree, ended up writing a Lisp program to solve SOMA cubes as part of one of the things he did. Yeah. So it sounds very similar. Not that his program was similar to yours. He just used recursive descent. But the thing about that I figured out about SOMA cubes is they have that same sort of symmetry issue. So you can solve them in much, much less time if you just start to look at the symmetries. There's some number of centers of sides, corners, and so forth. You just identify the different component parts. And that seems to be a really nice approach to solving all sorts of problems in that space.
Well, that's what the system did. But the trick was to actually calculate the symmetries. And the problem was that the previous algorithms to calculate symmetries of polyhedra were exponential. The best algorithms were exponential. Yeah.
And what did you get it down to?
And in my representation, they were low order polynomial.
Oh boy, that's way, way better.
Yep. And that's what really got me to thesis. That's really what made the whole work was that discovery.
Okay. It's those mathematics degrees and transforming spatial, topologies into algebraic equations. You're talking about a brain here.
I think as listening to that, comparing that with disinformation, which is, we're wrestling with still today. It seems to be a stark contrast between that and taking defined polyhedrons and rotating them and combining them, to create 3D puzzles. But it's
think it might be very closely related.
Well, and as I'm always saying, these points over time, right? I've told you before, one of my first firewall, discussions with a customer in the very first year, I'm sure we were selling the Borderware firewall, standing there, run through the stuff that was getting usual to me, talk about security and viruses and whatever, and I just on my feet said, well, just don't think think about where this all goes, right? That it may not just be a virus that deletes your file. Imagine a virus that added or deleted the word "not" in business documents. We're not looking forward to doing business with you in the future, right? Here we are today. Ran before, long before I was standing there thinking the same thing. This is this whole range from cybersecurity, the Stuxnet, right? For anybody who hasn't heard this one before, Stuxnet was this 2010 kind of thing. Actors, had written some software and delivered it to the Iranian government and got it inside a nuclear enrichment facility buried underground with 10-foot concrete walls. And it did certain things. It broke some of the equipment, but mostly it was a disinformation tool. It made the operators think things that weren't true. So they took actions based on that disinformation that stalled the Iranian nuclear program for years. By getting inside their heads, not getting inside their computers.
So when you think about what Rand's talking about, when you talk about information theory, Shannon's information theory has this. That's H of X or something that gives you the information content of a message. And so, all those words that we say, all those letters in those sentences and so forth can be compressed into far fewer. So the actual content is much less than the stream of gobbledygook that's coming out. That's an easy way to say it. May not be true in human-to-human communication, because it might be that all those subtleties around our expressions have different triggers in the other person's brain in the analog world and so on and so forth. But certainly in the digital world, in the communication from afar, getting messages across and so forth, that's part of the world there. The idea of disinformation theory, being able to measure the disinformation content, that's fascinating because when you think about it, all this stuff out on the internet, we talk about how do you detect disinformation? Well, if you had a disinformation theory that could be executed mathematically, then everything that comes across the network, you could just have a number that came with it that says, oh, the disinformation content is, you know, this portion of the total content here. And if it's much bigger than zero, guess what? Oh, probably it's a lie, right? Or it's not true or what have you. So it would dramatically change the measurement problem, which is a big part of being able to cancel out disinformation. I mean, when you think about it, you could just have a measurement threshold. And if it goes above the threshold, you just don't transmit it. I mean, as a simple analytical process that would completely change the nature of things, get rid of all that disinformation without a problem. Of course, the only problem is nobody would ever hear anything I said because probably, you know, just saying. But yeah, so I think it's fascinating, the stuff that he goes through. But that interaction with the government, I have been in that interaction. I've seen that interaction. I think it's extremely destructive, especially in the computer security arena. So part of this is how proposals were evaluated. You send a proposal to the government to do work in computer security or cryptography or something like that. The proposal, because of the way the U.S. government works, the CIA or the National Security, I think it's the NSA, always will get a view of it. They'll get to look at it, and they'll have the ability to give a result, right? So when you propose something, you get points effectively, and the proposers with above the threshold of the necessary number of points you have to get to qualify for getting the funds, and from there, it sort of goes top down. The amount of money available goes to the best one, then the next best, next, until they run out of money. So what happens here is the NSA had a policy, because they can't reveal any secret information about anything they're doing, that no matter what they did to review it, they would always come back with a, you know, 5 out of 10. Couldn't say it was bad. They couldn't say it was good. They'd just be completely neutral about it. The problem is if there are 5 reviewers and you have a 5 out of 10 from one of them, if everybody else is 10, right, then you have a 45, which is, you know, 9 out of 10, right? That's the average, is 9 out of 10. And the threshold on these things was usually higher than that. So not a chance. That one, you know, that one vote just kicks you out of the running. You can never get a grant in anything in that arena. So it destroyed the ability of people to get funded. And this, you know, whole thing where they won't comment, but they tell you, don't do that. And, you know, we don't do that. But if we did, we couldn't tell you. And if you contacted somebody that did it, even though we don't do it, they wouldn't tell you that they did it. And they would, you know, disavow any knowledge of it. You know what that means? That means they're doing it heavily. You know, these denials and crap. So I just think it's destructive to the field. It has been destructive to the field of cybersecurity over the years, this whole attitude of, you know, we don't want to talk about it, so, you know, go away, don't do it. And my advice to anybody, if you're going to do something and the government says don't do it, if it's research, if it's not physically dangerous, do it. Do it and pursue it. And do what Rand did, don't tell them. But don't make the mistake I made of telling them that you didn't tell them. Now, I mean, I had no idea they were interested. I had no idea that they cared. I thought it was just fine. I was just naive at the time. But that naivete across the course of my life, I think, has cost me a lot.
I don't know. I consciously embrace it to a certain level, right? You know, you have to decide to do the things you think are right, you know, and, you know, understanding the consequences, you know, that, you know, the Silicon Valley get rich quick thing, you know, we got the, you know, the intellectual property, right? You know, the, you know, you know, again, as I try to remind folks, I take security really, really seriously, right? But, you know, you need to know where to apply it, right? And this analogy in my head isn't working that well. So let's just talk open source, right? Call today, with a bunch of, couple dozen of the best people in the world talking, supply chain and open source and so forth. It is what it is, right? And you can't run anything without it. Now, if nobody, if you could take, things you put out into open source and make a lot of money on them, maybe, right? But that implies a whole lot of other things as well, right? A lot of time, effort, work, risk. And I'm comfortable with my decisions in life down that, my career down that path. There are, times I can look back and say, if I had just walked away or, didn't say or whatnot, I could have had X, Y, Z. But, I did. I think as I can look back, I think I can say to all or most of them, but I didn't want to, or that wasn't right, or it was, better overall. Right. And
this reminds me of the attitude of a knight. Right? Take the hazard. Right? Do the right thing. Take the hazard. Recognize you could get beat, you could get killed or whatever by doing the right thing, but you still do the right thing because you know somewhere inside you that it's the right thing. However, I'm engaging in these conversations over the internet with people who believe very differently than I believe. And what I find is that their social context is such that what they believe to be right is things that I believe to be terribly wrong. And what I believe to be, terribly wrong and terribly right are contextual. I have difficulty understanding the logic of it, of the way they think about it, because I view it as not logical. That is, it's inconsistent. And to me, that's, abhorrent. But then guess what? That, again, has to do with my underlying belief system. And I have a factual basis for the belief that the world moves forward, whatever forward is, when you take the sort of the factual point of view, this thing, that science does that says that if it's refuted, it's not true. and so the net effect of that is we have engineering and science. So if you believe that the world is better for engineering and science and our, all of this other stuff, then you can buy into that perspective. But I think there are plenty of people out there that say, no, all that communications equipment, all those, phones and cellular stuff and devices and all that stuff is just bad stuff. It does not improve humanity. And yeah, it's fine. We die at 35, after having 8 children. And most of them die, in childbirth, right, or something, right, like that. But that's how, it's meant to be. And we think that's the right way. And I find it difficult to understand their point of view, but I also understand that they don't see my point of view. And, I sort of try not to judge them based on that difference in point of view. Having said that, when they come to try and kill me, I feel as if, if it's for me, it's going to be me. Sorry.
Yeah. All of that, though, is again, my... why I'm, with all my time and thoughts on America and all that that implies and freedom of speech and open source code and the internet and transparency and honesty and, capitalism, the economic systems, I'm pretty pleased with the current state of the world, right? Because I think there's a lot of evolutionary pressures at play, and those, can foil the worst plans. They can also make them flourish sometimes, but I think, in the market of ideas, these things continue to get worked out, right? And again, at my age, I grew up listening to folks just a little bit older saying we're all going to die in 1984 or 2000 or something, in the 70s. Paul Ehrlich, the population bomb, that awful 1968 book that said, that 100 million Americans are going to starve to death in the 1970s. And there's nothing anybody can do about it because those are just numbers and physics. And we keep solving problems because we keep trying things out. And there's always a lot of people, who believe things that just aren't going to work out. They either are just wrong or they're not the better idea. And that keeps changing over time because as that gets proven out, whatever that is, one way or the other, people tend to gravitate to the one that's thinks less.
Yeah, but Chris, If God would have wanted us to tell the truth, he wouldn't have made it so we know how to lie.
Yeah.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Pete gets manipulative and can't take it, so he lies about lying. Rand gets a vision for Vision at DARPA. Another pitcher fills us with their fluid pitch. More fraud, spies, and lies, and possibly even another story or two from Chris and Fred. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and foul. A good time and foul. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and foul.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.